When the student speaker at the convocation, Blake Harris, had said to all the parents that our children would miss us in about a month and for about 15 minutes, we all laughed. I hoped it was true, but we sure would miss her. When it was time to go, Hillary had pulled herself together and was ready. Not me. I wanted to stay for dinner. When 1998 began, I had no idea it would be the strangest year of my presidency, full of personal humiliation and disgrace, policy struggles at home, and triumphs abroad. And against all odds, a stunning demonstration of the common sense and fundamental decency of the American people. Because everything happened at once, I was compelled, as never before, to live parallel lives. Except that this time, the darkest part of my inner life was in full view. On January the 14th, I was in the East Room of the White House with Al Gore to announce our push for a Patient's Bill of Rights to provide Americans in managed care plans some basic treatment guarantees that were being all too frequently denied. And Hillary was being questioned by Ken Starr for the fifth time. My deposition in the Jones case came 3 days later. I had gone over a series of possible questions with my lawyers and thought I was reasonably well prepared, though I didn't feel well that day and certainly wasn't looking forward to my encounter with the lawyers, who were being paid by the ultra-conservative Rutherford Institute. The presiding judge, Susan Weber Wright, had given Jones' lawyers broad permission to delve into my private life, allegedly to see if there was a pattern of sexual harassment involving any woman who had held or sought state employment when I was governor or federal employment when I was president, during a time period from 5 years before Jones' alleged harassment to the present day. The judge also gave the Jones lawyers strict instructions not to leak the contents of any deposition or other aspects of their investigation. By this time, everyone involved in the case knew there was no evidence of sexual harassment. I was certain that the lawyers wanted to force me to acknowledge any kind of involvement with one or more women that they could then leak to the press, in violation of the judge's confidentiality order. As it turned out, I didn't know the half of it. After I was sworn in, the deposition began with a request from the Rutherford Institute lawyers that the judge accept a definition of sexual relations that they had apparently found in a legal document. Basically, the definition covered most contact beyond kissing by the person being asked a question, as well as a certain state of mind, but did not include any act by another person. The lawyers said they were trying to spare me embarrassing questions. I was there for several hours, only 10 or 15 minutes of which were devoted to Paula Jones. The rest of the time was spent on a variety of topics, with no connection to Jones, including a great many questions about Monica Lewinsky, who had worked in the White House in the summer of 1995 as an intern, and then in a staff job from December through early April, when she was transferred to the Pentagon. The lawyers wanted to know, among other things, how well I knew her, whether we had ever exchanged gifts, whether we had ever talked on the phone, and if I had had relations with her that matched their definition. I discussed our conversations, acknowledged that I had given her gifts, and answered no to the relations question. The Rutherford Institute lawyers kept asking the same questions with slight variations over and over again. When we took a break, my legal team was perplexed because Lewinsky's name had shown up on the plaintiff's list of potential witnesses only in early December, and she'd been given a subpoena to appear as a witness 2 weeks later. I didn't tell them about the facts of my relationship with her, but I did say I was unsure of exactly what the legal definition of relations meant. So were they. At the beginning of the deposition, my attorney, Bob Bennett, invited the Rutherford Institute lawyers to ask specific and unambiguous questions about my contacts with women. At the end of the discussion of Lewinsky, I asked the lawyer who was questioning me if there wasn't something more specific he wanted to ask. Once again, he declined to do so. I was somewhat relieved, but also confused and concerned. He said in a dubious tone, "Sir, I think this will come to light shortly, and you will understand." I didn't understand, but he seemed not to want to ask specific questions, nor to get my answers to them. If they had asked such questions, I would have answered them truthfully, and would have hated the words that came out of my mouth. During the government shutdown in late 1995, when very few people were allowed to come to work in the White House, and those who were there were working late, I had made a horrible mistake with Monica Lewinsky. I had seen her other times between November and April when she left the White House for the Pentagon. For the next 10 months, I didn't see her, although we talked on the phone from time to time. In February 1997, Monica was among the guests at an evening taping of my weekly radio address, after which I met with her alone again for about 15 minutes. I was disgusted with myself for doing it, and in the spring when I saw her again, I told her that it was wrong for me, wrong for my family, and wrong for her, and I couldn't do it anymore. I also told her that she was an intelligent, interesting person who could have a good life, and that if she wanted me to, I would try to be her friend and to help her. Monica continued to visit the White House, and I saw her on some of those occasions, but nothing improper occurred. In October, she asked me to help her get a job in New York, and I did. By mid-December, she'd received two offers and accepted one, and late in the month, she came to the White House to say goodbye. By then, she'd received her subpoena in the Jones case. She said she didn't want to be deposed, and I told her that some women had avoided questioning by filing affidavits, saying that I hadn't sexually harassed them. What I had done with Monica Lewinsky was immoral and foolish. I was deeply ashamed of it, and I didn't want it to come out. In the deposition, I was trying to protect my family and myself from my selfish stupidity. I believed the contorted definition enabled me to do it, though I was worried enough about it to invite the lawyer interrogating me to ask specific questions. I didn't have to wait long to find out why he declined to do so. On January 21st, the Washington Post led with a story that I had had an affair with Monica Lewinsky, and that Kenneth Starr was investigating charges that I had encouraged her to lie about it under oath. The story first emerged publicly early on the 18th on an internet site. The deposition had been a setup. Nearly 4 years after he first offered to help Paula Jones, Ken Starr had finally gotten into her case. In the summer of 1996, Monica Lewinsky had begun talking to a co-worker, Linda Tripp, about her relationship with me. A year later, Tripp had started taping their phone conversations. In October 1997, Tripp played the tapes for a conservative Republican publicist. Around that time, the Rutherford Institute received anonymous phone calls about Lewinsky and me. In late November, Tripp was subpoenaed in the Jones case, though she was never on any witness list provided to my attorneys. Late on Monday, January 12, 1998, Tripp phoned Starr's office, described her secret taping of Lewinsky, and made arrangements to turn over those tapes. She was concerned about her own criminal liability because the kind of taping she had done was a felony under Maryland law. Starr's office promised to protect her. The next day, Starr had FBI agents wire Tripp so she could secretly record a conversation with Lewinsky over lunch at the Pentagon City Ritz-Carlton. A couple of days later, Starr asked the Justice Department for permission to expand his authority to encompass the investigation of Lewinsky, apparently being less than truthful about the basis for his request. After the story broke, I called my attorney, David Kendall, and assured him that I had not suborned perjury or obstructed justice. It was clear to both of us that Starr was trying to create a firestorm to force me from office. He was off to a flying start, but I thought if I could survive the public pounding for 2 weeks, the smoke would begin to clear, the press and the public would focus on Starr's tactics, and a more balanced view would emerge. I knew I had made a terrible mistake, and I was determined not to compound it by allowing Starr to drive me from office. For now, the hysteria was overwhelming. I went on doing my job, and I stonewalled, denying what had happened to everyone. Hillary, Chelsea, my staff and cabinet, my friends in Congress, members of the press, and the American people. What I regret most, other than my conduct, is having misled all of them. Since 1991, I'd been called a liar about everything under the sun, when in fact I had been honest in my public life and financial affairs, as all the investigations would show. Now I was misleading everyone about my personal failings. I was so embarrassed, and I wanted to keep it from my wife and daughter, and I didn't want to help Ken Starr to criminalize my personal life. It was like living in a nightmare. I was back to my parallel lives with a vengeance.